Welcome to the WeGo Places podcast, where we catch up with WeGo grads who share with us the story of the journey to their unique careers. I'm your host, Brian Turnbow, English teacher at WeGo since 2001, and you just heard intro music from Andy Georgieff, class of 2022. Today, I catch up with the class of 2008's Kim McDaniel, filmmaker, choreographer, performer, and assistant professor at Utah State. Kim will share with us how she pivoted from a setback while studying dance performance and then expanded her creativity in film production and education. Joining us from the class of 2008 is Kim McDaniel. Kim, what do you do?
I am an assistant professor in the School of Dance at the University of Utah, and I'm also the program director for the Graduate Certificate in Screen Dance, which is an interdisciplinary certificate in the Department of Film and Media Arts and the School of Dance at the University of Utah. And so, yeah, I'm an educator, I'm a filmmaker, choreographer, curator, interdisciplinary artist.
Just to kind of rewind a little bit, you were always, you danced in high school as well. And then how did you know that you were going to take that to the next level where you went off to school? And where did you go to school after WeGo?
So I went to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I had my BFA in contemporary performance and choreography. And then I double majored. I got a BA in psychology. I was thinking about this last night. I was like, this actually started all in high school because I had tried out for the dance production, which I don't know if it's still there, but dance production was like this PE class that you could take and you had to audition for it. And I got cut my first year that I auditioned for it. I think it was like freshman year. And I was like really hurt by that. I was like, oh, how did I get cut? Like I had this like ego about it. And then I was like, I'm going to train, you know, I'm going to take ballet classes and I'm going to, you know, come back the next year and make the team. And so I did that. But I also like in the process of training and taking ballet classes, I actually really fell in love with dance. And so that kind of changed my entire trajectory of what I thought I would be doing just when I was like 15 or 16 years old.
All right. So tell me about like, what's it like to then to have that major at the university? Like, what are your classes like?
It was a real mixture of like performance and practice classes. So like in dance, they call it physical practice, which is basically taking technique classes. So contemporary class, ballet, composition, so learning how to make dances, and also classes like anatomy and more somatic classes, so thinking about how the mind and body connect and relate to one another. And then because I had like picked up this psychology major on the side, I was also taking, in Milwaukee, they have a real kind of like neuropsychology focus, or I guess like one of their branches of their psychology program is in neuropsychology. So I had gotten hooked up with a lab, a neuropsych lab, and was a research assistant for I think at least 3 or 4 years when I was an undergrad, doing research on like exercise and the impact of exercise and drugs on the brain. And that was kind of like complementary to what I was doing in terms of like physical practice and dance.
Can you maybe expand on like a couple of things, which would be like, what were the really interesting experiments that you saw while you were there? And then what were the kind of connections that you ultimately were able to kind of draw into your own application of your performance with everything that you learned there?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was interesting to me was that like, I think I went into psychology for two reasons. I mean, I thought it was, I dealt with a ton of injury, and that's like a huge part of my story and how I became a filmmaker. So I think I picked up the psychology major almost as like a security major where I was like, okay, if I get injured again or to the point where I can't bounce back, like I need to have some other degree to help me. And then like, the second part of it was that I was just like genuinely interested in human interaction and behavior. And so I think how this kind of ties is that what I learned as a psychology major was that actually a lot of psychology isn't really thinking about human like compassion and behavior in the way that I was interested. So like I was interested in like helping people or like learning, just like kind of like the complexities of like health and trauma recovery and like kind of like being a compassionate like listener and support for somebody. But like a lot of psychology is more, totally just like research based and like science based and like is kind of like removes the human element from it. And so I think that that's actually what I really learned in the psych major was that like I was not interested in doing psych research. And like even though I was like really interested in like neuropsychology and kind of the intersection of that and dance, like it just wasn't like the right, I kind of realized that I wasn't going to go on to get my PhD in psychology. Like it just wasn't the right kind of like pathway for me academically.
Tell me more about like the, because your major is one by which you know, you're learning things, but then you're also doing something that's so much different than what most people do, which is you're actually pushing your body to be ready to do these performances. So there's got to be a lot of just diet and training and all these other things. How does that all merge together to be successful with a major like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was actually really good for me was that, so I had actually gone to UWM and I actually hated it. Like I was like, I felt like I didn't fit in. Like it was just like a really difficult first year. And I ended up wanting to transfer and I had gotten into a conservatory in New York for dance and I was going to transfer. And then I found out that I needed hip surgery like a month before I was supposed to leave. And that kind of just like wrecked like the whole plan, right? Of like, like moving to New York and having this other like place and like education and all the things that I wanted or was looking for. And I ended up like dropping out of school for, it was like around a year and a half, and ended up going to COD. Just like taking gen ed classes just to like give myself something to do as I was recovering from this like really intense surgery. And so I think obviously I was like very crushed and it was like emotionally it was a really difficult time. But I think ultimately like I ended up going back to UWM mostly because I had like created friendships there. And I, at that point, like I just couldn't imagine starting over somewhere new. And so I went back to UWM and I had found like a mentor in the dance department there. And that really helped me change my outlook on dance and also like my own life. And looking back on it now, I'm like so grateful actually that like I didn't go to New York, because I think I would just have been like a completely different person if I had gone that way. And I think like, yeah, it's kind of like what you said, like dance kind of like breeds a culture, like a diet culture and like just this really like physical intensity to it that I think I would have honestly like really lost myself in if I had gone to New York. And looking back on it, I'm just really glad that I didn't. So yeah, difficult at the time.
What an incredible pivot. Yeah, like the way that, I mean, that could not have been, just as you said, you know, what a crushing development where you had forecast, you know, this is where I think I'm going to go to New York, and obviously all the different kind of narrative possibilities that happen as a result of that. But then, you know, like you said, you were able to come back and become stronger in mm-hmm. ways that may not have happened had you gone to New York. I was wondering if you could maybe expand more on the mentor that you had, like, when did it become apparent, like, oh yeah, this person is giving me exactly what I need to be better at this craft that I'm trying to develop?
Yeah, I think, so it was actually like a friend. So yeah, when I moved back to Milwaukee, I had actually applied to go to Marquette and I was enrolled in Marquette, but I still had friends who were in at UWM. And it was actually a friend who had recommended that I reach out to this mentor who kind of works in this like mind body practice and does individual lessons and kind of meets with students to talk about how they're using their bodies, you know, and how they could be kind of avoiding injury and different things. And so this friend had like kind of recommended to me that I reach out to him and just kind of set up an appointment and just like, you know, see, talk about what had happened, my injuries, and just kind of go from there. And I think that it just, upon kind of like having these somatic lessons with this teacher and learning more about my health and the way that I had, you know, habitually kind of used my body in a way that had kind of leaned towards a tendency of injury, and just kind of really developed this sense of trust that with this teacher. But I also think too, and like this even reminds me of like English class in high school, I think I was always looking for like, I mean, I think that there's that phrase that's like, and I didn't 100% feel this way, but I do relate to it. It's like students who aren't loved at home, like go to school to find love or to be loved. And I think that I definitely relate to that, where I was always kind of looking for some type of like teacher or some type of mentor that like saw value in me. And like I really leaned on my mentors in college and in graduate school as like a way to help me develop a sense of like value and worth for myself, which was really new for me. Yeah.
So how, again, restorative that must have been to, like, as you said, get your body right so then your mind could be right, and now you're ready to create again the way that a level. So what was like maybe your first then work once you kind of then, or maybe, I mean, maybe there are things that were maybe you never stopped, but like what was your maybe first maybe performance or choreography that like after your recovery from this that you remember most and you're most proud of?
I think it was, so like as an undergrad, you do this like senior thesis project. And I had worked with 4 dancers for that project. And there was just this one moment in the dance where the 4 dancers were just falling like in repetition, like over and over again for probably like at least 3 to 4 minutes. And that was like a moment for me that like always stood out to me, where it really felt, even though it wasn't like you wouldn't look at it traditionally and be like, oh, like that's dance. But it was this like choreographed repetition of like injury in a way that felt like a metaphor for my own embodiment. And it was a moment where I realized that like I was interested in dance beyond just like technique, but more in like the physical expression of like kind of like an emotional or like mental state.
Like what, when you watch other dancers, like if you just kind of show up at a performance, like what does another dancer look at? Like, because if I go to go see a performance, I'm just like, wow, everyone's jumping around. I may not have that. You know what I mean? Like I love the totality of it, but I'm sure you look at things that our eyes don't. So I was wondering, like, as someone who like studies dance, how do we know it's good? What do we know to look for when a dancer is at the top of their game, so to speak?
I think that it has to do with presence. And I think that like some performers naturally have this presence where your eye just gravitates towards them. And it doesn't mean that they're the most like, yeah, again, like technically proficient or could do the most turns or, you know, like jumps the highest or whatever it is. It's more so like they have this sense of like focus and intentionality to them that makes your eye just like naturally be drawn and you're curious about them in a way where you can tell that they're thinking about something. And yeah, I'm a big believer that like to be thinking and dancing, like to think and to dance at the same time, so that you are not just these like robots doing these like choreographed movements that don't mean anything. Like, why would we hurt ourselves or like do this really like destructive medium? Like if we can't think at the same time, basically. And so, but that's also like, it sounds like it sounds like almost basic to me when I say it, but it's actually really radical for dance to be like, no, I want you to think about something when you perform. Because I think that a lot of dance culture wants you to be like lost in the feeling of how it feels to be moving. But for me, that only caused injury. So I'm really, yeah, interested in having there be this like a cognitive process in tandem with the physical. Yeah.
Oh, what a wild swirling there. Because on the one hand, like you need to train your body to make sure that you fend off potential injury and because of all the various things that could happen. But at the same time, is there any room for improvisation when you do have to do things with such regiment, not like repeatability, but with that kind of tactical skill? Is there any room for some type of improvisation within the moment of dance itself?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that like when I work with dancers now, like a huge part of that of my process is improvisation, mostly because like it goes back to like what I just said, like when you are, there's an improvisation structure in the dance that you're making or creating, like it forces the dancers to think because they have to make choices like in the moment of performance. So it can't just be like, okay, like I need to be here on count eight. And like, that's the dance. It's like, no, like you have to be making choices in order to get to that spot on the stage. And it doesn't maybe matter how you get there. You just have to get there somehow. And I also think that like for me, having improvisation in my choreographic practice is a way for like the dancers to be empowered to be making those choices and also have like their individual personalities come out. Because again, like I'm just not interested in like training robots. I think that the kind of like individual personalities that shine when they make those choices are the things that are actually more interesting than like anything that I could ever create and set on them.
So that's so interesting. Yeah, I remember I was listening to something and they were talking about elite athletes or people who do things at the highest level with their bodies. And the host used the term fluid intelligence. And I thought that was, it's that idea like that, you know, it's that moves you away from the robot metaphor, but are able to kind of do things at a level of just such improvisation and brilliance in that moment. I love that that idea. So something I'm thinking about it all the time with that when I watch my Chicago Bears and whenever there's something like that happens.
I love that. I love how it's really poetic too. Yeah.
Yeah. No doubt. So okay. So your senior thesis was this a particular project. Now, what happens then once you graduate from University of Milwaukee?
So, the story of my dancing is like, again, just like a story of like injury. So I had actually my junior year, I had like rejoined the dance department at UWM, and then I had another injury while I was performing, and this time it was a head injury. And it was the one injury where I just could not, no matter what I did, like diagnostically or physical therapy or like anything that I tried to do to like recover and bounce back, like my body just basically like shut down. So when I graduated from undergrad, I was in a lot of like pretty debilitating chronic pain. Like it had disabled me to the point where like I couldn't work. I couldn't finish. So like something that was really amazing that the dance department did for me was like at that point I had met Cecilia Condit, who ended up becoming my film mentor in graduate school, and she was teaching in the film department at UWM. And she had kind of taken me under her wing a little bit. And so the dance department had said, okay, like, you know, you're too hurt to be finishing the rest of your dance credits, but like you can take film classes as long as you're like making dance films, you know, like we'll make it count. Yeah. They were just really generous. I think they were like, this girl's just got to get out of here. Like, just like, please, like, she's dropped out. She's already dropped out once. Now she's hurt again. Like, just get her out, please.
Get her to the finish line.
Yeah, right. But yeah, I mean, I was really grateful for that because I was still able to graduate. And then I had met Cecilia along the way. So really, like, me applying to graduate school and getting my MFA was like a way for me to buy myself time in some ways to like heal from this head injury thing. And at the same time, yeah, like keep my practice alive because I couldn't dance and I wasn't choreographing because I was too hurt. So it was I was kind of like, okay, I have to like evolve myself because I can't dance or choreograph. And yet I still want to make work and I still want to be an artist. And I need to figure out how to do that if it doesn't mean dance.
So what were some of your initial projects in the film department then, or in the film degree?
Well, I was like, I mean, I just remember like entering into that program. I was like shocked that I got in, first of all, because I had very little experience with film at that point. And I had like a ton of insecurities because I think I even remember like saying in class once, like, look, I'm just a dancer. Like, I don't even know like what I'm doing here. Like, and so like projects about sound, and I had never even thought about sound before. But like sound is a huge part of filmmaking, and I had taken a seminar class on sound. And then there was a seminar on touch. So both like how we're touched by things emotionally, but also like the tactile quality of like touch and screens. So that was a seminar class that I took. And really like the graduate program in the film department at UWM is really rooted in critiques. So there was kind of this expectation that you were just making films and that you would be getting critiqued on it every 6 months. And so, yeah, a lot of it was really self-directed, but that's really when I started kind of like developing my own practice in film, just because I knew that every 6 months I was going to basically get grilled on it publicly.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting kind of question. How does one receive criticism? Because like you must have, I mean, how you talked about like how crushing it was, you know, freshman year when you got cut, but then you went into to dance and then film, where part of this is where you may be publicly and not necessarily dragged, but like things that might be perceived as flaws with something that you have worked so hard with. How do you either prepare yourself for that, or how do you take it in stride without making it really something that's devastating to your ego? Or is that an impossibility to do? Because most people maybe don't have that experience. How do you absorb it and then move and work with that?
This is like an amazing question, and like I feel like one that I'm still trying to figure out as an educator.
Yeah, me, there's no, yeah, it's an infinite horizon to be able to reconcile it, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I just like a couple years ago, like I ended up making like it's called like The Art of Critique, and it's a PowerPoint for my students, and I think it's something like 90 slides or something, you know. It's just like talking about like all about like even talking about like the nervous system, like what happens when you feel like you're getting attacked, you know, and the kind of like how your brain shuts off, you know, if you feel like you have to defend yourself in a particular way. And honestly, I don't know if it actually helps or not. Like when it comes to like critiques in my own classroom, like I hope that it does. But I think too, like part of my motivation for like making that PowerPoint for my own students was because I just have a really hard time relating to being defensive during critique, because I feel like I love getting critiqued. Like, and it's really, I've had like some really brutal critiques, but I feel like at the end of it all, after I can, you know, breathe, like I'm always very, very grateful for like the truth that like arises like out of the critique session. And I think what I've learned is that, yeah, I think I'm just always like happy to be receiving feedback on my films. And I don't know if it's just because I'm happy. I'm just like happy for somebody to spend time with it. And there's just kind of, I feel like gratitude just that somebody's like willing to spend their time talking to me about my work. But yeah, I think especially like in graduate school, like kind of going through these like every 6 months, like these reviews, there were some reviews that went really well and then others where I left and I was like, that was terrible. And I wish it went better. But at the end of the day, I still feel like I really benefited from it, even if it wasn't like anything that anybody actually said, but it was just like the feeling that I got after I left where I was like, I was not ready to show that. And now I know.
Trust has to be so important where like you believe that the value of the person who's critiquing your work is in search of that truth that you were talking about. So when they do offer it to you, despite it maybe hurting a little bit, if you believe that they were in pursuit of that truth, then it is easier to absorb, as opposed to if you felt like that person was coming at it because they were being petty or jealous of something else that you did, you know, like all the other tropes that go along with that. So I like how you said that, like if it uncovers a truth about the art that I was trying to get at, then it was worth it. I love that. That was just so, so well said.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I'm always trying. I really like look towards Cecilia, like my mentor in graduate school, because she has a way of like giving like the most, like she can say something to you where she'll be like, that was terrible. But like the way that she says it is so lighthearted where you never actually feel like bad about yourself.
Yeah.
Like she just like has this way of like delivering the feedback where you're almost like laughing, you know, during it because you're just like, oh my God, like, you know, like you're right. You know, like how can I be mad at you? And I'm still learning how to do that in my own practice when I give critique because I think that I'm a little bit more critical than that. But I wish that I could be sweeter about it.
Yeah. How exactly do you deliver that? Because everyone's going to have their own set of gloves, you know, how to deliver the news in such a way. Like, so like, some people want, you know, the soft landing, other people are just like rip the Band-Aid off and give it to me straight. So yeah, I totally get that. So, all right. So then you start. So then what is the final project for your film degree then?
So I started working on a series of films in graduate school that I called Exit Strategies. And this was like a 6-part film, short film series. And basically, yeah, I got started because I realized that I had kind of exhausted all of the kind of like medical roots of trying to heal from this head injury. So and I kind of realized the only thing that I hadn't done was really look internally and try to ask myself what types of memories or things that I just basically didn't want to face in myself that could potentially be keeping me stuck. And so yeah, the films were kind of about like trying to release like memories of like shame and trauma and seeing if by doing that, if I would physically heal or feel better. And then kind of like through the process of making those films, I really kind of, learned. It was kind of like a process of identity formation for me and kind of really becoming, I was like, you know, 28 or 29 by the time I was getting close to finishing them. And I suddenly realized like, oh, like I'm finally starting to find out like who I am actually, you know, like, you know, 15 years, 20 years after I thought that process had actually started. So yeah, it's like this process of kind of becoming, who I am and being more aware of it. And kind of, again, like thinking about my own patterns and my own habits and the relationship of my own mind and body to physical pain.
Something so personal like that, is it, how do you let yourself put that out there when it is such a intense journey for yourself? As you said, like things like it's pain, it's shame and all of that. How, how do you allow that to be out there in such a way that you can kind of reconcile the possibility of someone of the judgment? Because most people don't have that kind of ability to even express themselves, A, but B, to be able to kind of put that in an artistic form. How did you kind of get the nerve to be able to put that to art?
I'm trying to think. I mean, like, the first thing that I can think of, again, like, yeah, it goes back to this, like, yeah, idea of, like, how important it was to me to have a mentor and somebody who believed in me. Like, I remember, so Exit Strategy 2, which is, like, the second film in the series, but I actually made that film first. And so I remember showing, like, a cut of it to Cecilia, like, after class one day, like, as a graduate student, like, I was TAing as part of the assistantship. And so I asked if she could stay after class just to, like, look at this short thing that I had made. And after she watched it, I remember asking her, you know, is this worth sharing with others? Because it feels so vulnerable. Like, I don't know if this is, like, I think you, I was like, you need to tell me if this is worth it or not. And she said, yes, this is worth it. And I honestly, like, I say, like, if she had said no, I probably wouldn't even have made the rest of those films. Like, I think the project probably would have just died right there. But just because, like, I had that one person who really, like, believed in me, like, kind of gave me this, like, spark to realize that I should keep going. And I think that there was, like, yeah, like, a strength in that, like, knowing that I had somebody who really believed in what I was doing.
Yeah, that's special. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So, okay. So you finished. So Exit Strategies, it was the big project. And so what then happens after that? Because you now are in education yourself. Trace the line for us of how you got to Utah.
So, yeah, I graduated with my MFA in, 2018. And then I was working and, adjuncting. So basically, like, in higher ed, it's like teaching, but without, like, a full-time contract for a year. And that can really burn you out. And I was already feeling pretty burnt out by the end of that year. And so I was looking for a full-time position. Something that ideally was tenure track. And so I had applied to a couple positions, and then I was hired out at the State University of New York at Binghamton, which is like 3 hours west of New York City. So I had moved out there for a position out there. And then eventually was hired for a tenure track position out there. And then from there, moved, kind of hopped over here to Utah for this position teaching dance film in the School of Dance at the University of Utah. So, it's kind of like teaching in higher ed. It's like you kind of have to go where the job is. Sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
Have a lot of choice about where you end up going. I feel really lucky, though. I mean, the amazing thing about Binghamton was that the cinema department there had a really experimental focus, and the kind of their department has this like legacy for experimental filmmaking. So they really understood kind of like what I did, and they saw a lot of value in it. And I took the job at Utah just because there was still this part of me that was like, I wanted to be a dancer. I'm I think there was this moment of like, how did I get here? Kind of like, how did I, and like being a filmmaker really, again, it's like almost like the story of not moving to New York the first time around. It's like, at first I was really resistant to getting the MFA in film, but then like by the end of it, I was like, I'm so grateful actually that my life ended up unfolding this way. But there was still this part of me that was like, I never got to have what I always wanted, which was to be a dancer. So accepting the position out here kind of felt like a return to that in some ways. I was like, I've grown up so much and I've developed so much, and yet like, I still want this part of my life. And I wanted to see what it would be like to be like immersed back in a dance culture, but teaching film.
Wow. That really does seem like the best of both worlds. So if we're going to go back to the metaphor of the left brain, right brain, you really have all of that in your current position. So what's a typical day like for you? And what's the, I guess, the autonomy that you have as an educator in terms of maybe developing curriculum? Is it set for you, or are you able to kind of explore where you want to go with that?
It's like something amazing about the position here is that I'm my position technically is an assistant professor in screen dance, which is this really particular word for that dancers use to describe like dance on camera or like dance film, basically. And I'm also like the program, like the screen dance program head. So I have a lot of agency in thinking about the curriculum because I'm the only one here in who's teaching it. So like it's like total control. There's some really amazing things about that. And then at the same time, it can also be like a little isolating, kind of being the only one. But yeah, I think that I feel like I have a lot of freedom to like be designing my classes. Like I was just thinking about this for next semester. Like I've kind of gotten sick of like my syllabus that I've like made for especially my undergrad class. And I'm like, oh, next semester, like we're just going to like every week we're just going to be doing something different. I was like, we're going to go to the pool. Like we're going to shoot with GoPros in the pool. We're going to go to the botanical garden. Like we're going to have like 2 weeks where we're just going to be like outside the whole time. I was just, so there is like a lot of freedom where I'm already thinking about like overhauling my own syllabus. And as long as, yeah, like you're following the university guidelines or whatever, and you're not totally being chaotic, you know, like your evals turn out fine, you know, like nobody really, as long as the students are learning, then nobody really, I don't really feel that supervised in that way. So that's also really great.
When you see a student kind of unlock themselves because of maybe a project or an idea that you gave them to kind of pursue, I was wondering like what was one of those moments you're like, yes, that's exactly how it was supposed to work?
I mean, I think that like some of the most rewarding experiences are the most challenging ones for me. I mean, yeah, I think that there's a couple examples I'm thinking of where this student was really resistant, and by like requesting to meet with that student, like I actually learn about what's going on, because it's like never actually about me or the class, right? Like there's just so much going on, and I think like by learning that or like having more of an insight into that, I have a lot more compassion for them. And then there's like, it becomes more than just about like teaching the Adobe Cloud or something, you know, like it actually becomes about like understanding that they're a person, that they're a human being. And I think like that's what I cherish about teaching. It's like the moments where it's not just about like the curriculum, but you actually have the chance to like really change somebody or help or support them in a way. And I think it's, I mean, I don't know how you think or feel about this, but I think it's also really hard as an educator to like know when that's happening. Cause I feel like I don't often hear from students actually who like come back and say, you really changed my life or something. Like
that's very rare. Yeah.
It's like, it can feel like kind of thankless in some ways. So then you kind of have to trust that the process is happening, even if you don't see it or hear. And so, yeah, there was one student, I guess, during COVID when I was teaching online, and it was like hard to know, right? I mean, like COVID was such an awful, difficult time, but like I feel like this student in particular, like there was this moment where he was unmuted and I could hear that he was watching TV in the background. And like to me, like that's, that stuff is just like I'm like, oh, like this is just like soul sucking, you know, like where his video's off and you realize he's not even paying attention to anything you're saying. And at the same time, I'm like, I'm not going to force anybody to turn their video on. So I was like, okay, like this kid, like he didn't get anything out of the class. Like it's fine. But then like I saw him in person like a year later and he came up to me and was like, hey, like, do you remember me? Like I took your class online. And I was like, yeah, I remember. And he was like, that class was amazing. Like I'm still making films. Like I like, can I send you like a film that I made for feedback? And I was like, yeah, like, of course. Like it's, yeah, of course. And then he left and I was like, okay, like, again, like, I don't know, maybe, like, I don't know. Like,
you never know. I know. Wow. Well, right? That seems like, I think what you've just described is it can be a very common experience. I think for a lot of us are like, wait, where did that come from?
Yeah. So,
well, thank you.
Right. Yeah, it's like that moment where it's like maybe I was like the only educator who like wasn't gonna yell at him for having the TV on in the background, and he just like super appreciated that. Like I have no idea, but yeah, I was, it was just that moment for me where I was like, I never know what's going on, but it's like you just have to trust that something is changing.
So then on the other side of that, you know, you have to find a creative space to evolve and adapt and all that. So how does, you know, like sometimes writers will go down to the coffee shop or they, you know, they'll go up to the attic of their garage and lock themselves in there for, you know, there's all these stories of where people or writers will find their way to kind of activate that kind of creative muse for them. How does that happen for someone who creates dance?
I think that like some of it comes through with like just like opportunities, like residencies. So like this year I'm in residence at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. And I have this like studio space in the museum as part of that. And so just like having a designated space that isn't my apartment to go to, that is like away from my cats. And just like doesn't have like any cat fur anywhere. And I was just like there to just like focus on like my practice and like the project that I'm creating for that. But I also think for me specifically that like laughter and joy is like a huge inspiration for me. And I think like moving around the last like six years or so, like kind of like uprooting myself and having to start all over again in different communities. And this is like the first year that I've actually really felt in Utah. Like I have, developed some friendships and that, you know, like where I have like a community around me. And like the other day, like, you know, I went out and, you know, was hanging out with some of the folks that I've met out there. And I came home and I had all this like energy to like open up a project and kind of start editing it. And it was really late at night, but I was like, I have to take advantage of this energy now that I have it. And so I think like feeling connected to other people and being in community is like a huge motivating factor for me, because I'm like reminded that I'm part of the world and I'm not, you know, working in isolation. And yeah, just having those like bonds is really important.
So let's say that you had a blank check to put on a production of your vision or whatever it may be for dance. What take me through the process of like would you go about either budgeting or kind of creating the process to make that vision happen? Assuming that cost was not an issue, how does one put together the ideal production for something like that?
Oh my gosh, I've never been asked this before.
I should have warned you. I always like asking these like what if questions.
No, I love it. I feel like I have to dream more. I mean, I think first is like probably like, yeah, I guess I'm thinking back. So like I had applied to a Creative Capital grant last year. Creative Capital is like one of these huge kind of like arts grants you can get as an artist in this country. And they had asked for a budget. And so that was really the first time, I think the grant is like $50,000 or something. That was really the first time where I was like, okay, like I'm making a budget as though I'm going to have $50,000, which still in the grand scheme of things is like a penny, you know, for so many, for so many things. But as a dancer, I was like $50,000, like I could do anything with this. So yeah, I mean, I think the project that I had kind of conceptualized for that was that, you know, living in Salt Lake, there's a huge environmental crisis going on with the Great Salt Lake drying up. And there's this prediction that in like 5 to 10 years, there's going to be arsenic in the air and it's going to be this huge, you know, like environmental economic collapse. And so I had, you know, conceptualized this project where I would be able to go out with dancers and specifically dancers who identify as having disabilities, which is like a community that I feel I'm a part of, especially with all my injuries that I've dealt with, and that we would go out and have this kind of site-specific film dance project either near the lake or it's not really that accessible, to be honest. And so however we could access the lake, and that there would be payment for the dancers involved and also, anything else in terms of like film production and equipment and people and all these things that go into making a film. And that was the project for this creative capital that I pitched. So, I think that like the main things for me are like being able to pay the people that you're working with and then also have it be something that can last. You know, I mean, the amazing thing about a film process is that it's not, you know, like a performance is kind of like a weekend and then it's done, and you just put in so much time and energy and effort and money into just like putting it on for like one or two nights. But the amazing thing about film is that it can live on, and so the process is ongoing even after you get everybody together. And so I was just interested in like thinking about that both as like a metaphor for the lake being able to live on, but also just, extending the process so that there was like some joy in remembering the community of it all. I'm going to think about that question because
I think you uncovered like a really kind of cool idea, though, is that, you know, that there is performance, if only observed by the eye, is only thing that can be held in the actual memory of the person. Whereas film is something that will last forever, assuming that the medium can continue to be iterated. So it's a really unique way of looking at memory that's so fascinating. Not that there's a way of articulating this question very, you know, concisely, but like, has working with film changed how you perceive memory as a result? Because you kind of touched on that in your last answer.
Yeah, this is like a huge, it's something that has actually stuck. It has kept me stuck for about 5 years now. So it feels really like, the fact that you're asking it to me now, because I was just talking about this yesterday, actually, with somebody. But I think so, like, I read this book in 2019 called Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors by Janina Fisher. And it really changed my whole life. It sounds dramatic, but it was true. And just because the book starts thinking about memory in a way that I had never thought about it before. And some of the premise of the book is that like you don't have to tell your story in order to heal from it. And that was actually in opposition to everything that I had been doing in my film practice. Yeah. And so then I kind of like had this question of like, well, what am I doing? Like, if I don't have to tell my story in order to heal, then what's next, actually? And I think like what I have started realizing now, 5 years later, is that it's the process of telling the memory is more important than the memory being told. So it's like, in my exit strategy process, it was like I was telling the memory actually so that I could get validated by an audience for what had happened. And but of course I didn't know that at the time. But now it's like when I'm working with memory in my practice, like I am actually validating my own self. And then the audience reaction is just like the audience reaction. Like I don't need anything from them anymore because the process of making it has been enough for me. And so that's where I feel like I'm moving next, where, like interested in how the process or like the methodology of making is the thing that's important. And then the outcome is just what it is.
Oh, wow. Yeah. A lot to think about in that answer, but yeah. I love that. So now, okay. So now I'd mentioned this maybe at the very beginning of our discussion, which is how have you changed or evolved in your idea of what dance means to be human, right? So you had this uniquely experience where you're like, wait, I didn't get what I wanted when I was cut from that, but then this has become your life work. You must have kind of thought about what dance means to be like this peak expression of our humanity in ways that are nonverbal, which are sometimes the most strongest ways of expression. What is your take on dance as peak human expression?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I think the reason why I fell in love with dance was because I had no other tools for articulating my feelings. And so, yeah, like what you just said about it being nonverbal, like that resonates with me so much because I didn't know how to articulate myself in any other way. And I think that that was one of my main reasons for always wanting to be a dancer, was because it was this form of expression that I really relied on for so many years. And now that I have grown in so many different ways and realized that like ways of articulating myself that are verbal or are through film or are through another form of expression, like I feel like I actually have realized that dance is not the center of my universe and like that it's so healthy actually for me that it's not. And that also, and that maybe it shouldn't be the center of anybody's universe. that like actually like just by relying on one thing is actually can be really dangerous. And so actually like when I look at dance now or when I'm thinking about dance now, it's like whenever I see a dance that's like really, really committed to like dance, it actually kind of like annoys me in a particular way where I'm just like, oh, like it's so much dance. Like, could it just be less? Like, and just because like that, like attachment, I guess, to what dance should be or look like, to me, I'm like, oh, that's only ever caused suffering. And not just for me, I think for so many dancers who get injured or who get kicked out of the medium or who aren't even accepted in the medium because of the way they look or whatever it is, like I think that the medium can breed like a toxicity because of its attachment to its like these like ideals. And for me, I'm like, oh, it could just be like less, like it could just be less, you know, like I'm interested in people falling down, you know, for 4 minutes, like that's great. Like I don't know if that answers your question.
No,
but
it kind of does, because I mean it's just that last part that you said there about like what is it that you think would be the most important sea change that could change our consumption of dance such that it wouldn't feed that toxicity that you just mentioned?
I think there's so many hierarchies in dance that are just representative of like other hierarchies, you know, like throughout this country and the world, right? And so I think that it's like a question of, yeah, it's like not just a question of like, how are we rethinking dance so that it can be more inclusive or equitable or accessible, but it's also, it's like the structure of dance mirrors like the structure of patriarchy or like the structure of racism. It's like a lot of these structures that are already in our country, dance is just, you know, mirroring what's there already. And so I think for me, that's also where I'm like, let's just become a little bit less attached, you know, to this, because none of these structures have served us at the end of the day.
I could see that. So Kim, where do you want to be in like 5 or 10 years? What's the next chapter then for you?
I just hope that like I am still making work, and like I think that, yeah, something that like I know speaking with friends and other, yeah, like educators, academics, it's like burnout is just so intense right now for everybody. And so I think that like, I think especially right after I finished my exit strategies, I was like, man, I could just take like 5 years off and just not make anything for like 5 years just because I felt really burnt out. But I think, yeah, I just hope for myself that I continue finding strength in my practice. And also, I think like an intention that I had for a long time was like, I just want to have like peace in my practice. But then like, in the fall, I was like, actually, like, peace isn't good enough. Like, I want to be happy, too. What? I'm like, it's like not just peace. Like, I actually want to find joy in what I'm doing, too. And I hope that's next. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so cool. Maybe I have one more question about just the what you've seen in terms of technology has, you know, from when you began your film degree, it seems like the medium of photography and video has been democratized in a way that everyone can do it, even though it doesn't mean they should do it. Do you think that that has been kind of a net gain for the actual filmmaking craft, that everyone has a video camera in their pocket and all that, versus how much do you need to kind of know what you're doing versus just put it in their hands and maybe good things will happen? That you have studied it and now you're seeing this again, this explosion of people having access to this technology. Is it going to make art better, or is it going to flatten it in terms of, or, and maybe I'm creating a false binary with that, but like, what's your take on the growth of this technology that now everyone can be a filmmaker in some ways?
Yeah, I think there's like pros and cons to it. I mean, I think that, so like I collaborate often with a disability activist and her name is Petra Cuppers. And when we work together, oftentimes like we'll just go out with our phones. And a lot of that is like an access practice because these cameras, like a high grade, yeah, professional camera, it's heavy. It's gear, you know, tripods are heavy.
Sure.
Like we're both not going to do that to ourselves if we're just doing something kind of on the fly. And so, yeah, like we've made films on our phones before and it's gone wonderfully. And it's also, yeah, an extension of like this disabled film practice. But then on the flip side of that too, I feel like it's not just like, something that I struggle with my students sometimes is like, just because you have a video like access on your phone doesn't mean that it's going to like turn out well. I think that it's like you still have to kind of know the rules and like how, it's like you have to know the rules in order to break them. And that's
right.
Yeah, kind of how I talk about it with my students, where it's like, you still have to know like, why something should be on a tripod versus handheld, you know, like there's still like an intentionality in what you're doing that matters if you want to share it with an audience. I don't know, I think it's complicated, and I think that, yeah, there's a lot of conversations that I'm not completely involved in terms of like AI generated imagery, but I think that, like, yeah, my first reaction to that is that it's just scary, because it's like artists are like the most underpaid, like least valued profession anyways. And now you just want like a computer to be doing that work, you know, anyway, like why not make the computer like work in a factory or like do like manual labor first? You know, like why does it have to go to art first? So I think that, yeah, I'm curious to see what happens next, but it would be great if they could just like use the technology to like, in a way that actually releases people of having to do labor. And art is labor, but it's not like standing on your feet for 12 hours working in a factory.
Right. And what you said before, I think you made a nice distinction there, which is that when you were talking about your collaboration with the other filmmaker, there is an obvious intentionality in using that versus where the other one might be just, I have content, but there was nothing really kind of behind that. But then at the same time, you don't want to gatekeep that person's exploration initially by saying, well, you don't have anything there. So, yeah, what a weird kind of balancing act that you have to have with all that. Oof.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I tell my students, I'm like, if you're intimidated by the technology, then use your phone. But by the second project of the class, like you should be using the camera, you know, like why? Yeah. Like we have the cameras. So like, let's use them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're right about the way in which we have to start thinking about will AI create a type of diminishment of really just trying to search for new ground that has never been thought of before, because AI is ultimately just something that has been already done. You're just reshuffling the cards in terms of what it is, as opposed to making something new that only we can make as the creative act. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So true.
Yeah.
So, Kim, this has been so great. It's so great, like, having someone walk us through a creative life, a creative career, and then and your role in education. And I was wondering if you could, I mean, you've given us so many gems of learning, but I was wondering if you can maybe give us maybe just one or two more ideas of or any two tips for success for current Wildcats.
I would say, yeah, find a mentor that you trust. Yeah, who you feel like will lead you, yeah, can guide you, and act as a support for you during high school and maybe even beyond. And maybe, yeah, I'm trying to think of what I would have told myself in high school. I think that it's just the beginning, actually. Yeah, I think everything for me felt very urgent in high school, like that I needed to make decisions like about my future, like right then and there. Or I felt like a great amount of pressure that what I did there or didn't do was going to really impact me. And in some ways it's true, but in other ways it's really just the beginning of your life starting. Yeah.
Love it. Love it. Well, Kim, thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck with your dancing and all your other creative pursuits. This has been just a great, great talk today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. Do us a favor and spread the word about WeGo Places by sharing our interviews with other Wildcats on social media. If you want to search past episodes or stay current, subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere where you get your podcasts. Just search WeGo Places. And you can also follow WeGo Places on Facebook and Twitter at WeGo Places Podcast. If you know of a former Wildcat who would be a great guest, send me a direct message on Facebook, Twitter, or even at school email at brianturnbaugh@d94.org.